Last week, I came across a Rashi I'd never come across. It was in a line in last week's Parsha where it said that when Joseph centralized power in Egypt in order to feed the people during the 7 years of famine, during which time the Israelites were brought to Egypt, one of the things is, you remember they did is over the first 3 years, the Egyptians ended up having to sell everything they owned to the state in exchange for the rations that Joseph had put aside in the storehouses, because no one had predicted such a long famine. And in the first couple of years, they had to give up. First year, they gave up their money. The second year, the Egyptians sold their livestock for food. And in the third year, they sold their land. When they sold their land, there's a line in the Torah that says, and it's kind of a weird one, it says that, I don't know if it's a Vayarem, Vayavir, and Joseph moved the people using, you know, Ayin Vet Resh, he moved the people off of their land and into Arim, into cities. And Rashi asks, what's going on? It's one thing for someone to say, I own this land, I need the food, I will sell it, you know, I give Pharaoh, I give the state the deed to the land in exchange for the food, but why move people off their land? Why move them somewhere else? And Rashi answers, it's to teach them the experience of being in exile. It's to teach them the experience of not owning land, of not having a right to land. It's to teach them the experience of being the other, of being the person who is a slave, the person who doesn't own anything. And you almost have to get moved off of your land. He said, Rashi said, Joseph wanted them to feel how the Israelites feel, how the B'nai Yisrael coming there, that they don't own the land. They're there in the land at the pleasure of Pharaoh when they come to Goshen. And that, of course, in shepherd culture, you don't own any land. I mean, from Joseph's culture, God owns the land anyway. You could see Joseph taking what he learned as a child, which is we're shepherds and God owns the land, to Pharaoh's going to own the land, and everyone's just going to realize that they don't have an entitlement to land. They're going to get the experience, as Rashi says in his language, of being in exile, just like the Israelites. And they're going to learn compassion from it. Does that make sense? They're going to learn the compassion of what it's like to be a slave. Interestingly, there's a very early manuscript of the Torah that says that that's a scribal error. It doesn't make any sense that he would move the Israelites, which is Ayin Vet Resh. It's not Le'avir. Resh looks just like what other letter, for those who know the Hebrew alphabet? Every kid gets Resh and what mixed up? Dalid. So if it's not Le'avir, he moved them, it's Le'avid. He enslaved them. Which actually makes a lot more sense. That's the way the Septuagint renders it. So that it actually is. So we have a Rashi on, he moved them around. He made them want to feel like what it's like to not be a landowning Egyptian, what it's like to be the people who are poor. And but it works the same if it's Le'avir. He enslaved them and didn't move. And it doesn't say that he moved them into cities, because like, how are they going to farm if they're in cities? It's pretty confusing. It just says he enslaved them and he put them into servitude. Instead of Arim, Ayin Resh, it's they do Ayin Vav Dalet again. He turned them into, it's translated often serfs, but he gave them the experience of what it's like to be a slave, not a landowner. Makes me wonder, why does Rashi think that? So let's go back for a moment. Let's posit something that the Torah never says, which is slave owning okay in Egypt prior to this whole story? Of course it is. It's okay all over the ancient Near East. So of course the Egyptians have slaves, they have household slaves, they buy and own people. Do they have limits on how long someone can serve as a slave? No, there are no limits on that. In the revelation of Mount Sinai, we have limits largely. It's usually 6 years or less. And how does one become a slave? In ancient Near East, it's always debt. It's almost always debt. I mean, actually, it's not true. If you're born a slave into a slave holding family, you stay a slave, and you become a slave when you owe money you can't repay, and you're often enslaved for life. In Judaism, in the Torah legislation, you're enslaved temporarily to pay off that debt and to get back on your feet, and then you're returned to freedom. So I was thinking about this in the context of Martin Luther King weekend. And think, the Egyptians own land and they own slaves. And famine comes along, and they're all in debt. They're in debt to Pharaoh because of the rations that Joseph has hidden on or has stored on Pharaoh's behalf. And they have to become slaves because they lose their land and their food and their money. And Rashi's like, they had to learn that to be compassionate. And then what happens as we transition from Genesis to Exodus next week, what are we going to read? That the Egyptians decided to enslave the Israelites. That rather than learning the lesson of compassion, they learned this weird lesson that it was all the Israelites' fault in the first place, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, the Pharaoh sells it, but the people buy it really, really quickly. That how did the Israelites cause famine? How did the Israelites cause Egypt's problems? I mean, it's pretty clearly cosmic. It's like blaming the Jews on global warming. I mean, at least blame us for something you got some basis for, even if that's more pathetic. But how do you blame them for that? So the people who were supposed to learn compassion by being made slaves or servants or serfs or non-landowners or from their debt themselves don't learn anything, and they go back to enslaving in a different way and in a way a more cruel way. When I was little, Susanna Heschel used to come to our house for meals. She's the daughter of Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of the five greatest minds who's ever lived in the human species. He was the architect of the conservative movement. He was my father's advisor at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And Susanna was a household friend. She wrote an article on Martin Luther King and her father. And so I'm not the originator of any of this material that's coming up I'm going to mention. Why did Martin Luther King and Abraham Joshua Heschel get along so well? Well, first of all, she points out something I already knew, which is that Heschel grew up the successor to a Polish Hasidic family, like a great Hasidic dynasty, very conservative, old-fashioned religion. And Martin Luther King grew up in a Southern Baptist old-time religion church. But both were not educated there. Martin Luther King went north to Boston, and he studied in the group of seminaries that I got my master's in, the liberal Unitarian-leaning divinity schools of Boston that I was part of the consortium in. And Heschel left to study at the University of Warsaw and the Reform Seminary. He wanted to leave conservative religion behind and be enlightened. Both ended up returning to their communities. Heschel is like an Orthodox rabbi in a conservative movement, and Martin Luther King back to Atlanta and to the South. So they both had a very similar form of enlightenment. When Martin Luther King was in Boston and he was studying, this is before he ever met Rabbi Heschel, he wrote in a student paper in 1949, "Jesus was a Jew. It is impossible to understand Jesus outside of the race in which he was born. The Christian church has tended to overlook its Judaic origins, but the fact is that Jesus of Nazareth was a Jew of Palestine. He shared the experiences of his fellow countrymen. So as we study Jesus, we are wholly in a Jewish atmosphere. There is no justification at all of the view that Jesus was attempting to find a church distinct from the synagogue, and the Gospels themselves bear little trace of such a view. Throughout the Gospels, we find Jesus accepting both the temple and the synagogue." By the time he met Heschel when he was older, if you notice in Martin Luther King's liberation speeches, you don't hear a lot about Jesus. Think about it, he was a very strange Baptist preacher. He alludes sometimes to the figure of Jesus, but he very rarely quotes Paul or the New Testament. He almost entirely limits himself to the Jewish prophets and to the book of Exodus. The African Americans in this country are B'nai Yisrael. The first time we heard that word in the Torah was just, what, two weeks ago. When the Israelites come to Egypt and they're about to be enslaved, they're B'nai Yisrael, called for the first time the Israelites. In fact, in the very famous speech, I think it was the I Have a Dream speech, I get the two most famous ones sometimes mixed up in my porous brain. You remember when Martin Luther King looks up in those old reels and he says, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." Of course, the words of Amos. The most famous book on Amos and the prophets was written by Abraham Joshua Heschel. And if we think that was Martin Luther King influenced by Heschel, well, guess what? That's Heschel's translation. There is no Christian Bible that was in existence at the time that Martin Luther King gave that speech in which that was the translation. That comes directly from Heschel's book, The Prophets, where Heschel translates that. Originally, it's in German, and it gets translated into English as that. He was a man who quoted the prophets because, when you think about it, Jesus really preached to the poor. And what Martin Luther King, part of what made him great was he preached to everybody. He was preaching to the oppressor as well as to the oppressed, which is something Jesus didn't do much of, but who did it? The Hebrew prophets. The Israelite prophets were talking to everybody. They weren't like, oh, you know, us poor orphans, widows, foreigners, the other people are going to get it someday. He was preaching to everyone. It's like God's looking down at us saying, what are we doing to them? It was Heschel who got Martin Luther King, historically, to oppose the Vietnam War. And actually, it was Heschel who convinced Martin Luther King, you're focused on the civil rights issues, and they're paramount, but you got to speak about the Vietnam War, too. They got to be linked. And Martin Luther King listened. So, when Martin Luther King spoke in Alabama, he quoted from Exodus and the prophets. And he said that we are B'nai Yisrael. When Heschel had his rabbinical assembly conservative movement 60th anniversary, his 60th birthday party, the keynote speaker of the conservative movement was Martin Luther King. And he spoke about Heschel. 10 days later, Martin Luther King was assassinated, and Heschel was invited to speak at the funeral. It's said that King taught Heschel how to pray within the context of civil rights, and that Heschel taught King that the prophets are speaking to God's indignation at the world, and that the preacher and the rabbi must be a spokesperson for God. So I go back to the parsha to finish, which is this. It's interesting to me that we live in a time of enormous national debt. And as you know, we just increase our debt over and over again. And I have a really strong feeling that the people in this sanctuary, whether you're middle of the road, or whether you're blue, or whether you're red, or you're libertarian, I have a pretty strong feeling that we all agree on one thing, which is, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe there's an economist out there in the pews today who's like, no, national debt is good, it produces growth, and debt is good. But I don't believe that. I mean, I believe that, I mean, there are actually economics formulas for that, and we exceed those formulas by far. We take on way more debt than is considered appropriate. And I'm looking around us, and I'm looking at the failed states. I think Mexico is this close to being a failed state. Half of the countries in the Middle East are failed states. I'm worried that America will someday become a failed state. In the great movies by people like Norman Jewison, who back in Rollerball in 1971 predicted that eventually national debts will be so great that we will have to be bought out by corporations who will run our countries. I'm not sure that's a science fiction fantasy anymore, because debt produces slavery. Eventually, you owe. And it's just very interesting to me, back to Rashi, that if the Israelites, if the Egyptians were supposed to, because of their debt, in order to live, in order, who's going to give me food, we're supposed to get the experience of slavery, not the full-out thing, but the experience of it enough to say, oh my God, like compassion for those who are poor and in debt, and we're all in the same boat together. But when one tyrant lifted up and said, it's the fault of the immigrants, it's the fault of those slaves, that we must enslave them again, that somehow everyone bought into that. They didn't learn the lesson that we're all in it together, and the goal is for none of us to be slaves. They seem to learn the lesson that the solution is to blame the poor rather than to collectively solve our problems. We're in a week where our Jewish mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, he has to preside over the discoverings of a commission, which we all knew what the answers were going to be. the Chicago Police Department for decades and decades and decades. They just change the stories of officer-involved shootings to whatever they want them to be. It's just completely documented that there is shootings of people based on their color, regardless of whether they hold a weapon or what their crime is or what's going on. And yet, I wonder if our future is going to be realizing that those are what Dr. King spoke about, that we need to put racism behind us and see that we're all really in the same boat, or whether we're actually going to go to a place where people say, you know what, I think that's the right thing, that it's somehow that person who took my kid's spot at the college, you know, because of affirmative action, it's their fault. It's those people's faults who come here and don't do their fair share. Rather than seeing it's the leaders who have not looked toward the future to store the grain, but who borrow money to create empires today that we hope do not fail before our children and our children's children grow up. The love between Heschel and Martin Luther King and their mutual support as leaders for our country.